Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is
Neat.
It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
It's February now, so goodbye, dry January.
Oh, yeah. Have you drank?
Well,
did you go crazy?
No, I'm having a kombucha right now that has some alcohol in it.
Oh,
it's not like one of those
alcoholic
kombuchas.
Watch out. Watch out. Taylor's having kombucha.
I just found I got a lot of work done this last month, I've been waking up really early in the mornings, and my skin looks real nice. So, I'm just kind of gonna try to keep some of those habits.
Take it easy. Yeah. Don't need to spend yourself all at once. Yeah. Not all in one place.
I hope any of you that also completed your sober January, hopefully you found some benefits or just, you know, took a good break and it was good for you, whatever. Or if you are drunk right now because you started midnight on February 1st, well, that's your life to live, whatever.
It's okay. Hopefully you just got something out of it. That's the point.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So how was your week? How's it going? What was the highlight of your week?
What was the highlight of my week? Did I have a highlight to my week? I don't know. This is pretty good. This is
great. I'm having a great time.
Yeah. I mean, I just worked a lot and then have been hiding in my house because the weather's gross here and cold.
It's nice to hide in your house when you have a nice house to hide in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did this doesn't sound like, oh, what a decadent evening, but I've been so on lately as far as making work and doing stuff that I kind of was feeling a little tired yesterday. And so usually if I'm watching, I'll have something on in the background, a podcast or maybe a show I've seen before, while I'm drawing or while I'm working on stuff at home. And I let myself sit down on the couch and watch something with my full focus. And I don't think I've done that, at least not in the past month or so.
You gave yourself real relaxed TV time?
Yeah, made myself a cup of chai.
Wow.
And had a few squares of dark chocolate.
I'm impressed.
Uh-huh. And I watched Battle Angel Alita, or Alita Battle Angel, what the movie called it.
Go off. That's great.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I would recommend it, sort of. It's a good movie, if only it had an ending, and anyone that has seen it knows what I'm saying. But how was your week?
It was good. I kind of decided that I want to start keeping track of the things that are good, not just I have my wall of to-dos. I have a bunch of sticky notes on the back of my door, but I'm also I don't want to call it a gratitude list because I feel weird about that. But it's not just things that I did that I should recognize were good things that I did for myself. I took a dance workshop this week, but also things that are good things in general. And the thing that is good for me this week is that my houseplant is coming back to life.
Oh, that's something to celebrate. The return of life.
Yes. Oh my God. And I have to give credit where credit is due, because I would not have known how to save my houseplant if it weren't for this person I have been following on Instagram that got featured on Dazed. I'm talking about DJ Freedom, aka Fridella DeVille.
Okay.
Is an Instagram person. Actually, if you want to support people, independent people, follow his account and tell Instagram to give him his account back because his account got deleted. But he has it's a really good plant knowledge feed. It's not safe for work, so it's not for everybody.
Okay, so he's a DJ.
He is a DJ.
And he talks about plants.
Yes.
But he's also not safe for work. These are three facts that I'm trying to, I mean, they're adding up to in my mind to something that's really great.
It's good. It's very good.
Here's how to take care of some houseplants. Sexy stuff.
Yes.
Who wants a hot remix?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't actually listened to any of his music. That's like the next step in all my fandom. Right. But like, yeah, no, is like just seems like a really cool person.
A true Renaissance like, man.
Yeah, really. It's for real, for real. But like, yeah, so DJ Freedom taught me about mealybugs, which are like, they're like very tiny. Hmm. There's like these really tiny bugs that like, they basically, like if you ever see like it looks like little cobwebs or like mold on your plants, it's actually mealybugs. And like, you can see them, but they're super tiny and they just like suck the nutrients out of your plants.
Oh no, little vampires.
Yes, they're like tiny, they're essentially tiny vampires.
That's adorable. And you hurt them?
Yes, I did. Well, I don't know if I hurt them. I think I just like repel them. Because okay. It's really easy, like they were hurting my plant. They were killing my plant.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'd given up hope, like I'd stopped taking care of it because I was like, nothing that I do is what this plant likes. Like, I don't know what to do. I'm a bad plant parent. And I found out about mealybugs and all you have to do to keep them off of your plants is like, you just like make like a solution of like either neem oil or peppermint oil and water, and you just spray the leaves and it keeps the mealybugs away. So I've been spraying it and it's coming back to life. But
I don't have any problem with my house plants right now.
You have all of the like very resilient house plants.
Well, that's what, like, I don't know if it's that my house plants are just chill, they don't need a lot of attention, or if they are living to spite me. Because it could be that, because, you know, like, I kind of forget they're there until like maybe like once a week. I'm like, oh right, living things are in this house outside of me and my cat. I need to give them things to let them keep living.
Yeah, you're supposed to like talk to them.
I should be better. I feel bad. I have plant guilt. I have plant guilt.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, it's like I look plant at them guilt. I'm like, I need to like give you time, but I'm like, I don't know, like, you're low on the list, plants. I'm sorry.
I mean, you spend a lot of time here.
I am around.
You play music.
Yeah, I play a lot of music for them.
Yeah, they like that.
I need resolutions. I know it's February now. We can still make resolutions. You need to be better at plants. Because they're just there. They're like, oh, you think you can kill me? You think you can kill me? I'm just going to live.
Yeah, you have all of the plants, like the money tree and like the, I don't know what it's called, but the viney ones are like particularly hard to kill. But I don't know. I haven't really been talking to my plant, but I talked to her today. I talked to her because she's looking good, and I let her know. Okay, so we're actually not doing a podcast.
Most of this shit.
We're not going to do a podcast on plants today. We're doing a podcast about monks, I guess.
Yes.
So we have a Patreon question from Susan, and Susan asked, I'd love to learn more about those monks who brew alcohol. The Trappists, I think? Yes, you're right. They're Trappists.
A bunch of, well, I guess.
Oh, yeah. More than just the Trappists.
A lot of monks. And then there are different sects. Like, the Trappists kind of are breakaway from other monks.
Yeah.
They're all kind of under the umbrella of, like, Catholic, right. Christian.
They're all
at the time.
Christian.
Yeah.
Most of them are Catholic. And then a lot of the ones that we're talking about are of the Benedictine order.
Yes.
Because they're super strict.
Yeah. And the Benedictines eventually led to the Trappists derived from the Benedictines.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. So a lot of monks brewed a lot of stuff. They brewed wine, beer, mead, liquors, and liqueurs.
Mm-hmm. And they also make a lot more stuff than that. I don't know if you guys know this. Monks make stuff. Currently, only 12 of the world's 169 Trappist communities make beer. The rest make coffee, fudge, fruitcakes, jam, cheese, bread, or clothes. You know?
Cool.
You could get some monk clothes if you want.
So the why the monks make stuff, booze specifically for the podcast we're doing.
That's what our podcast is about.
Monks that make cheese is something that I would like to hear about, but we're not the specialists
on
that.
I'd like to hear about them making fudge.
Now, that sounds cool too. Oh, you know, monk fudge is the shit.
Oh, it's gotta be good.
Oh, monk fudge.
Monk fudge? Why does monk fudge sound wrong?
It sounds wrong.
Give me some of that monk fudge.
Oh, that monk fudge. Oh, God. Really important figure in all of this is Saint Benedict of Nursia. He was an Italian monk. He was born in 480, and he's the eventual patron saint of Europe. His ideas were really big in shaping the Christian philosophy of the Western world, and it shaped the core tenets of monastic life throughout the Middle Ages. He, as a monk, had this really important writing. It was called The Rule, later, after he was sainted, called The Rule of Saint Benedict, which was basically just a document that included the principles and practices that all people in monasteries should uphold.
All right.
And there's a couple tenets from that that influence what we're talking about right now. The first one, why did they make the stuff? Well, one of the important...
Why did they make stuff?
One of the important directives therein was that monks should earn their own keep, and they should also donate to the poor by the work of their own hands. So in the centuries following, they would produce all they, you know, differentiated their portfolio, all these different things they developed. Another big thing that came from that doctrine is that they should provide shelter and hospitality and kindness to pilgrims and travelers. And I mean, what's more hospitable than some homemade booze?
When I'm traveling, let me some homemade booze.
Yeah. Well, and actually the oldest plans for a modern brewery are from, they're from a monastery in Switzerland, the St. Gall Monastery. But these plans which they found, they date back to like 820. And they show that this monastery had three breweries, one that was for the guests of the monastery, one that was for like the pilgrims and the poor, and one that was for the monks themselves.
Oh, yeah. And that just like that became like kind of the model for a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until like, later.
Yeah. And we'll come back to that because I think you've got some cool stuff as far as the differentiation there. But yeah. So, you know, you made the stuff. You wanted to share the stuff. And then last, two more things that come into play here. Obviously, wine was used for the sacrament. So.
Right. Well, that's going to be useful.
Yeah. And last, one of the notes that I found on a couple things, which I think is just kind of funny, is that during periods of like Advent and Lent, during fasting periods, that good old liquid bread kind of helped them through.
Oh, yeah.
So sustenance, I guess.
All right. I feel like that's cheating a little bit.
That super feels like a cheating on a fast. Like, I went without food for 7 days to please my Lord. You drank beer the whole time. Yeah, yeah, I'm wasted.
That reminds me of, like, somebody argued that, like, you could sustain yourself by just drinking Guinness. Like, this, like, goes along with, like, when we did our Guinness episode, like, we talked about, like, it being kind of, like, pushed as, like, a... It's nutritious because, like, it has a little bit of protein or whatever. But, like, somebody argued that, like, you could exist on Guinness. And there have been people who have, like, tried it. Nobody lasts more than, like, 4 days.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah.
I feel like if my dad knew that was a challenge that existed, that would be bad news.
It's not good. Like, it doesn't have everything you need to survive.
I mean, I'm willing to try it out. You know, I got a month of clean living under my belt. Why not take on a... Beer only.
Let me just give y'all a piece of advice. One cannot live on beer alone. That's it.
I think it's valid. But apparently these monks did okay for a while. That seems like a pretty chill fast. I feel like I did that fast a few times in my college years.
But fasting for... Great. Fasting for Catholics is different. Like, you don't just, like, not eat forever. Yeah.
You don't eat certain things at certain hours.
Actually, I don't know what traditional fasting and... Like, I only ever did the don't eat meat thing.
Or, like, the fish Friday thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, because, like, fish technically isn't meat in the eyes of the Catholic Church.
Right.
I am not saying fish is not meat. I think fish is meat. But... If like religiously it's not, but that's, and also actually I saw that a lot of the monks are vegetarians, except for sometimes they eat fish, so they're actually pescatarians, but according to Catholicism they would be vegetarian.
Like just look at the fish and go, nah, you're not an animal. Floppy little vegetable.
About that.
Is that in the Bible? God looked upon the fish and said, nay, you are not an animal.
Thou art vegetable.
And the fish is like, excuse me? You made me, bitch.
I am not sentient celery.
I'm sorry, fishes. So that's why they were making stuff. That's good. That's why they were making things. Now let's talk a little bit about more detail about what they made and kind of what their contributions were to these areas. Obviously, first off, beer.
Yeah.
They're I wouldn't say their biggest contribution. As you mentioned, it wasn't like the most percentage, but right. it's kind of what they're most known for and definitely what they do the most of still today.
Yes. I mean, like, yeah, collectively, beer is definitely what we think of when we think of monks making things. Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, at least I do.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't really think about them making cheese that much.
Well, it's one of those products that I think still reaches our shores, and also something that even you pointed this out, that a lot of beers that don't necessarily come from monks, they still try to make it look like they do.
Oh, yeah.
Or like Abbey Ales, which are made in abbeys right. or adjacent to abbeys, but aren't
they're not
Trappist.
Made by monks. Well, yeah, and also like today, like even Trappist beers are not necessarily, like the labor is usually done by like outside laborers, but the monks own the stills, they own like, it's like having like a collective ownership right. of the brewery so that they can control the company and allocate funds in the way that they see fit. And they still don't make a profit on it.
Right. It still all has to circle back somehow yes. to supporting themselves in charity. And it's like, it's one of those, like they have to, a monk has to oversee production, right?
Yes.
Like
yes.
they have to be present. It's sort of like a kosher thing. They have to be present at all stages of the production.
Right. Well, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, but like as you mentioned, yeah, they a lot of our really modern brewing methods were developed by the monks. Obviously, beer been around since the Babylonians, but, you know, monks kind of pioneered adding hops. We've talked about Hildegard many a times.
Oh,
she
yeah.
was a nun, right?
She was a nun, but she was a Benedictine nun, so she would have been part of the same kind of order.
Mm-hmm. There was a monk, Arnold of Sassan. I believe, and he was eventually sainted. He was sort of renowned for inventing a better filtration method for beer. But one thing that I found kind of interesting about him is that obviously to become a saint, you have to perform miracles. One of his miracles was actually that it was during, like, you know, a time of plague. He implored the members of his church and his, like, you know, the surrounding people to drink beer, not water. That the uh-huh. And I mean, he wasn't aware of the science behind this, but he was sort of like, you know, the beer that we make in our monastery will protect you from the plague. And an astounding amount of the people that he had under his influence survived the plague. So it was seen as a miracle.
Drink my magic beer. It will protect you.
I mean, you know, like what was actually happening is the water was full of disease and the beer was not. But that's one of his
means to an end.
Yeah. I mean, he was a sciencey saint there. But he's the saint of Belgian brewers and hop pickers now.
Science adjacent.
Susan's original question specifically addressed Trappist monks. So yeah, so Trappists come about because they all kind of come, they all come from Benedictine monks. Right?
Yeah, they're part of the Benedictine rule and the strict observance. They have to pray 7 hours a day.
That's a lot of praying.
That's a lot. They're dedicated.
That is a lot of praying. The Trappist moniker was sort of a reform movement that happened. It began at a place called La Trappe Abbey in Normandy in like the 1600s. And basically there had been kind of a rise of like intellectualism in a lot of the monasteries. Mm-hmm. So they really wanted to double down on that like penitent, like focus. Like they wanted to get back to like acts of hard physical labor being a big part of what they did, which kind of worked well for the brewing because that really made them focus on that and double down onto that. And so that sort of put a separation between Trappists and all the other monks and allowed them to really come to the forefront of like the brewing industry in a way that they still hold a significant spot in today.
Right. Well, I mean, when I was looking at like the history of monks making alcohol and why, like, it really just kind of, the thing that kept coming to the forefront is that the conditions were just like right. They had all of the resources, they had the land to cultivate, they had a large team of people willing to work together towards perfection, essentially,
right.
Because of like the strict discipline of their order. They saw any chore as an opportunity to serve and glorify God. So like, they're gonna, I mean, that's kind of like the idea behind Trappist beer today is that like it's, they care about the product that they're making. They want right. to make the best possible thing. And they also like built into having this large group of people living together and working together is that they had a system where they basically had institutionalized memory. So like knowledge could be easily shared and passed down. You already mentioned this, but alcohol being a health, considered a health right. drink and like kind of medicinal and essential for preserving life, like that, like what better way to help people and serve the community?
As we're talking about Trappist monks, this is something that I've seen on labels and I have a rough understanding of, but tell me more about these kind of three systems of...
Right. So you mentioned before the three different breweries that they had, like at the monasteries, they would have a brewery that was dedicated to making beer for their paying customers or travelers. They had one that was like for the monks, and then they had the basically the poorest quality one was the one that they would give to the poor.
Okay.
I mean, that's like, that's kind of what it was.
All right.
Like,
well, they were giving them free beer.
And it's just like, this is help you survive. Eventually, they discovered that they could run water through the mash several times to get more out of the grain. And they also figured out that people would pay more for stronger beer. So the runoff system, basically, like running through multiple times, ended up replacing having three different breweries, which is a lot more concise and efficient. So the first run would be the richest, and that goes to the travelers or paying customers. And the second run is for the monks, and the last run through the mash is for the poor. And so this is likely the origin for terms like single, double, triple, quadruple.
So the like the higher the number, the first pool would be the quadruple?
Yeah. Basically, they used X's to signify the alcohol content. So yeah, the first run that would be the richest and the strongest beer would be like either a triple or a quadruple.
Oh, okay.
And then it would go backwards from there.
Wait.
So it wasn't the like single, double, triple, quadruple wasn't about the amount of times it had been run through the mash, it was the opposite.
Okay.
So the
higher the number, the
less runs it had.
I have to ask, and I don't expect you to know the answer off the top of your head because we're just learning this information. But I have to ask, do you suppose that's where the cartoon bottles of booze that have XXX on them?
I bet it.
Do you think this is where that comes from?
I mean, that's what they like from what I can tell, they actually used X's to represent alcohol content. So like, and that comes from Trappist monks, that comes from the Trappist beer.
They literally
marked the bottles with X's. So
I'm
going to say that's right. I mean, fight me on it. I don't know.
Well, possible origin for the Acme, like, you know, in every cartoon ever where you've got like a drunk person, but it's a cartoon, so you can't show them having drinking actual alcohol.
I'm going to claim it. Come at me, internet.
All right.
The other thing I'm gonna attribute to Trappist is like basically kind of the whole idea of like craft beer. Before the Trappist, we don't really have like people like, you know, we've talked about making beer in the past, like people were just kind of guessing. They put like a bunch of herbs and stuff together in a mash. They might have used a stick that had yeast in it because they didn't know they had to add yeast. Like, and I mean, I'm talking about like real ancient methods of brewing, but like the monks, because they were making something for the purpose of serving God, they put a lot of thought and work into the quality of the beer, which is something that we see now in the craft beer movement. But that's really coming from the tradition of monks. And we still associate like Trappist beer with a higher quality beer product. So I will mention this is a little bit more current than what we've been talking about. But today Trappists are still making contributions to the way that we make beer. I'm going to call them resource conscious monks. They're thinking about saving water. There's a current waste of 7 liters of water for every liter of beer produced that happens when you're brewing beer. There's an abbey on the Dutch-Belgian border, Koningshoven Abbey, the first brewery in Western Europe to construct a plant-based water filtration system that avoids that waste. So they basically have like a large greenhouse where they have like a whole bunch of plants, like 70 species of plants, sitting above bins of wastewater that flow through the pipes from the brewery, and the interaction of the microorganisms on the plant's roots and the bacteria in the water purifies it for reuse. So they are still thinking of innovative ways to make beer better and be nice to God's creation.
Well, very cool.
Hey.
Well, and of course, you know, this is all beer, but they also did a lot of really amazing things for the world of wine.
Not surprisingly, they're really into that stuff, you know.
And, you know, of course, this is monasteries were they were known for their wine, especially in France. Mm-hmm. Really, in the roots of monasteries making wine is kind of the roots of wine culture in France as a whole. This goes back to the founder of the first French monastery, a man by the name of Martin of Tours. He was a Roman soldier. He was a Roman soldier who had this, he basically had, as the story goes, a dream of Christ. It's actually kind of a beautiful story. He ripped his cloak in half to give half to like a freezing like person and like a beggar.
Oh, okay. And then I thought you were going to say in the dream, he gave half his cloak to Jesus.
No, he actually did give half his cloak. In real life. Yes. Okay. And then that night he had a dream where Jesus had his half a cloak.
Oh, so he did give it to Jesus.
Well, maybe. That was Jesus in disguise. And so because of that, he was so inspired that he decided to turn to Christianity. And, you know, he traveled around for a while, eventually ended up settling in France. But now the important thing to know is that Roman soldiers were often versed in the art of winemaking. So
they like wine.
They do. Well, at the time, you had the Romans were making wine. It wasn't really that big of a thing in France. So, like, you know, this was sort of the birth of wine culture in France, developed with him bringing his techniques into the French monastery. And his contributions were vast, just his own personal ones. Even before you get, like, the spread of wine culture throughout France and in the monasteries, which does a ton of work, his personal stuff, like, he developed both Chenin Blanc and Chenin Noir.
Ooh.
He accidentally created the practice of pruning, where, you know, you kind of, like, cut off smaller limbs to produce overall better growth. This was by accident, though.
What happened?
This is a cute story. Also, you know, some of the stuff could be legend, but it's, you know,
if they're cute legends, we don't care.
Basically, he tied his donkey up in the vineyards of the monastery, and the donkey would eat everything from about knee down.
That donkey got into trouble.
He's just a little donkey, so it's everything like knee down.
He's a short donkey.
Yeah, he's a little donkey. And he found that those plants that the donkey had eaten the vines off of grew a lot better and grew better grapes. So that started the practice of pruning down your plants.
Don't give enough credit to that donkey.
That donkey, I know. Like, I'm giving the credit to the monk. The donkey really deserved a pat on the back. Another important concept that came from the monasteries in France is now we talk about terroir a lot in winemaking.
Terroir?
Yes. Terroir. Why is it so funny to you?
I don't know. I guess I'm not like hitting or hearing the R. I don't know why that's funny.
Well, it's not.
Please go on.
It looks like terrier, but it's not. It's terroir.
Terroir.
It's like the land. It's always, whenever
great.
Whenever we talk about like the aspects of the climate and the soil that influence wine, you're generally talking about the terroir. And this, the kind of understanding of this gets broken down into two halves, which is the climate, basically. And then the other part is they sort of built these little enclosures that would hold these kind of areas together that sort of shaped a lot of the landscape of, like, winemaking in France. But this concept of being aware of both the weather, the soil, what the natural, like, land produces in wine comes to us from the monasteries.
Yeah, because they got the time. They're going to pay attention.
Yes.
Yeah. Along with spreading viticulture knowledge throughout Europe, there was a few times where there was like anti-Catholic governments going on, like during the French Revolution and the German Second Reich, where like the monks had to get the fuck out of there. So that's why we, and the places that they went is where we get like a lot of the viticulture that we have today, like in California and Argentina, Chile, and Australia. When you think about like quality wines, you know, Napa Valley, when you think about Malbec, Argentina, Chile, like, so that was from monk runs.
Yeah, monk runs.
Runs, when they're running away, you know? Monk run.
Yeah, I like the monk that really launched the wine culture in California. It was like late 1700s. He was a Franciscan monk, and his name was Saint Junipero.
Oh, yeah.
Just a good
like
name.
Like the Black Mirror episode.
Just made me happy. It was easy for me to remember because of that. He settled in Alta, California. But yeah. And of course, if you're dealing with grapes, you're not just making wine. Oh, wait, we didn't mention Dom Perignon.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, Dom Perignon, well, yeah.
We've talked about Dom Perignon, but he's worth mentioning here again, too, because, once again, Benedictine monk who invented...
And
as I was like doing some reading, maybe other people had figured this out beforehand. He's just kind of the one that gets the most press for it.
Right.
He did figure out the cork thing, so that was important.
That's impressive. Yeah. You don't want exploding wine, you know. Yeah. But we also talked about this in like preparing for this episode. Like, we kind of take it for granted. Like, oh yeah, Dom Perignon. Well, obviously, when he was making his wine, he wasn't calling it Dom Perignon.
No.
So what we have today is just like it's owned by Moët,
right?
It's produced by Moët. It's branded so that like they're paying homage to him, but like that's not necessarily like he invented the method, but they're just no monks are involved in Dom Perignon.
They're not Benedictine monks currently making.
No, they're not doing that.
But of course, with all of this viticulture, you can make wine. You can also make grape-based spirits. So, you know, they made beer, they made wine, they also made liquors and liqueurs. Some of the big contributions in this world were in Italy, monks were responsible for the creation and expansion of grappa.
Yes, wine love made that distillate. Stuff.
Yeah. And Pisco in South America.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. Good for you guys. You're really doing it.
And also, while monks are out there making some heavier stuff, you got to thank the Irish monks because they probably invented whiskey and probably shared that knowledge during a mission with the Scottish. So those Irish monks are to thank for the... whiskey cultures
all
of
medicinal,
Ireland,
and, you know.
Oh yeah. Well,
yeah. I heard that.
I don't know about an Irish monk. I think.
Well, I heard that they at least tried to say it was like.
Yes.
What was it? Somebody was like, definitely, guys, this will cure paralysis of the tongue. Irish whiskey. That is.
I think that's absolutely true, though, right? Well, not actual paralysis, but you know,
yeah.
It definitely gets you talking.
Oh, okay, sure.
Maybe it was a metaphor.
I guess I was thinking the opposite, where, like, sometimes when I drink too much, I can't feel my tongue anymore, so, like...
Whoa! So looked at, that's a lot of booze.
Well, I don't do that anymore.
What are you drinking?
But, you know, when you get a lot of alcohol on your tongue, it starts to feel numb.
Okay, all right.
And people start slurring their words when they're drunk because they don't have as much, like... muscle and motor control.
Well, yeah, this is all true, but
I'm just saying facts.
You're just describing what drunk is. I think they know, Liz. I think
your tongue goes more slack.
I don't think it helps.
But what about when you're at
a party and you're nervous and you don't want to talk, and then you get a couple drinks in you?
So the first couple sips of whiskey will cure your tongue.
There's
paralysis.
A bell curve. Yes.
Yes, a bell curve. A very steady bell curve until it just falls.
Yes. And there's no more words.
Because you're asleep.
Too many words, then no more words. Yeah. So one of the other spirits that came up, which I'm not super familiar with, Rompope?
Oh, yeah, Rompope. That was made by nuns,
Clarist nuns.
Yes, the Clarist nuns. Yes,
they're in the Spanish colony of Puebla.
Yes.
Well, I thought this was cute. So, and I've heard of this as like an old art preserving technique. They basically would use egg white wash to preserve paintings.
Oh.
And then they were like, what do we do with all these egg yellows? And so the nuns were like, make them into booze.
Why not? I always think about that when I have a recipe that calls for egg whites. I'm like, what do I do with these yolks? I should make Rompope.
There you go.
There's some other nuns that were getting into the biz.
Tell me about these nuns.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, you heard of Hildegard. We don't need to bring her back. We love her already. There were the Carmelite nuns that made, appropriately, Carmelite water. It's basically just like a alcoholic extract of lemon balm and other herbs. But that don't matter because they don't make it anymore.
That's too bad. That sounds kind of good.
I mean, you could probably make it.
I feel like, let's find a recipe for that.
Let's do it. Side project.
Yeah.
We're making Carmelite water. Not water.
Now, so we've talked about some spirits that were derived from this. There are some that are still out there today. And then there are some that are still out there today that you might think come from monks, but they don't. So we're now going to like kind of switch gears here and talk about some stuff that you can find in the liquor store right now. But a little clarification on where it comes from.
Yeah, so Benedictine, D-O-M, you'd think from the name that this was, a monk was involved.
It's got to be, right? It's right there. I mean, the D-O-M stands for to God, most good, most great. Like, it's a God thing, right?
It's a God thing.
Except for it's not.
So, okay, so originally, this was supposedly invented in 1510 by an Italian Benedictine named Dom Bernardo Vincelli. And he made it to fortify and restore weaker monks, you know, because they just need...
Monk revival juice.
Monk revival juice. Okay. They just need a little pick-me-up, you know? So the company that makes this thing now, this liqueur...
It's a liqueur, right?
Liqueur, yes.
Liqueur.
They claim that their stuff is based on the original recipe from the Benedictine monks of the Abbey of Fécamp in Normandy. But that recipe was lost in the French Revolution. So, like, what Benedictine D.O.M. is, was developed by a wine merchant named Alexandre Legrand in the 19th century. So, basically, they claim that what they're making is from this recipe, okay, but also that this recipe was lost. Basically, what I'm saying is it is not currently associated with or made by monks in any way. And it doesn't, like, you know, the name Benedictine makes you think that it would, like, at least, like, they have some association with the Benedictine order, but the Benedictine monks aren't getting anything from that stuff being made. Nothing to do with them.
Well, that's surprising. But yeah. definitely, Frangelico, which if you're familiar with it, Frangelico is a hazelnut liqueur. It's from Italy. And the bottle looks like a little friar.
It looks like a monk.
It looks like a little monk. He's got a little like, that's got to be, it's got to be monks, right?
Not made by monks.
Nope.
Not made by monks. So there, it's based on a legend. This is how the legend goes. In the 17th century, in the Piedmont hills of northern Italy, there was a hermit named Friar Angelico. And he used the local herbs, vanilla and hazelnuts, the abundant hazelnuts
that grew in the rich region of the northern Italy there.
He used all that stuff to make his unique liqueur. So it is inspired by a monk legend. Looks like a monk. Not made by monks. No. So it's produced in Canale, Italy. And it was originally made by the Barbaro family in 1978.
So it's pretty new.
It's pretty new.
Now, I will say as a caveat, this area probably, like, there were monks in those hills.
They were there.
And they did make liquors. Like, it was kind of like the myth comes from the fact that people knew, like, back in the day, monks did make liqueurs from the stuff that grew there. Hazelnuts were one of those things. So it's like probably there were some monks that made something that had hazelnuts back in the day in that area, but there's no connection between what the family made, what the Barbaro family made in the 70s and what was made back in, like, I don't know what, the 1500s.
Right. And they, like, the Barbaro family was not like trying to pull one over on anybody. They were like, this is inspired by a monk and we like this little cute bottle that we made.
Yeah.
But they were bought out by Campari. And Campari is, like, really trying to sell you this legend so hard. They want you to think this is the same, like, that there is some rich history. Maybe there is.
Maybe. It's a tasty product.
Maybe.
And it is well made, I'd say.
But it's not, it's, that, but what we're trying to say is it's not made by monks.
But if you want something that is... I know a lot of you listening to this episode, if you have some booze knowledge, you're probably like, hello, chartreuse.
Hello.
Chartreuse is kind of the one that, yes, you're correct. Chartreuse is made in monasteries. And the history of chartreuse is really quite exciting.
It is.
It's a whole caper. Now, I'm going to start, like, the history of chartreuse.
Start at the beginning.
Yes. It starts back in 1605. At a chartreuse monastery in Vauvert. It's just a small suburb of Paris. These monks received an ancient manuscript that kind of detailed an elixir, this elixir of long life.
An elixir.
Yeah, sounds very... I feel like Nicolas Cage would try to find this in a movie.
Yeah.
The manuscript was probably the work of a 16th century alchemist who had a lot of knowledge about, like, herbs and, like, blending and infusing and macerating them. There were, like, 130 of them. that were used to make this perfectly balanced tonic.
Now, and an alchemist's goal is to find the Fountain of Youth type elixir. So it still is not, well, it's not right.
Well,
they're correct, but it's good.
He found a formula to make something. It might not make you live forever. In fact, it might take some years off your life. But a lot of the monks were, they couldn't quite figure out everything that went into this, how to do it. So they sent it along to the mother house of the order, where there, the head apothecary, who was this Jerome Malbec, he figured out the formula and led to the eventual production in 1764. So he makes this, it's this heavily herbal infusion liqueur. It's like 69% alcohol. It's supposed to only be for medicinal use. It's very strong. It's very fragrant.
I like how they got this manuscript and they were like, oh, we gotta send this up the line. We gotta get on this, guys.
Oh, yeah.
We gotta make this.
I mean, it's called the Elixir of Life. I bet it was very exciting.
Yeah, we gotta see what this shit is. Make it.
And they
gotta make it somehow.
Yeah. I wonder if they were
make it. Somebody's gotta make it.
Like, maybe they were
let's get this done.
Maybe like a little disappointed that it's like, well, it tastes really great. People really like it, but they're not living forever. So what did we do? Elixir of Life. Yeah, maybe like an elixir for like a fun Saturday is.
Yeah.
Elixir for a rough Sunday as well. 69% alcohol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yikes. Yeah. Wow.
But they realized that the people, like, it kind of became popular in like the surrounding area. And they realized that people are buying it not to use it for medicinal purposes, but rather they like to drink it.
Because that shit will get you crunk.
Yes. So in response to this, they tweaked the formula and they produced green chartreuse, which is, you know, more what we now see on the shelves. And this was a slightly milder version.
Milder, you mean lower alcohol.
Yeah. I mean, it still was overproof. Yeah. But not slightly. Not 69%.
69%.
Yeah, I know what those monks were doing. They're just making a sex joke. Ha ha, 69%.
Because they definitely had a way to measure the alcohol percentage back then.
Well.
No, they didn't. That's how you know it was grand conception, because
God himself was making a sex joke. Is my recipe chuckle 69
in like 200 years they're gonna laugh about this.
But this is where the exciting part starts. So basically their new version of chartreuse, green chartreuse, becomes a massive success, reaches far beyond just the area immediately surrounding the monastery, kind of on the road to becoming a staple. But then, oh no, the French Revolution happens.
Oh no!
Which, you know, this is like 1789. All members of the religious orders are forced out of the country, including the chartreuse monks. The recipe escaped with a monk, but that monk was then arrested. Luckily, he wasn't searched, but he was sent to prison. So then he secretly passed the manuscript to one of his friends. This guy, Dom Basile Nantas, and then Dom Basile then does what I guess you wouldn't expect a friend to do. He sells the recipe.
Hey!
Yeah.
Hey!
To Monsieur Lyotard?
Monsieur Lyotard!
Monsieur Lyotard?
Yeah, I'd say that's Monsieur Lyotard.
He sells his recipe to Monsieur Lyotard, I think.
I like him as a villain.
As a caper.
Monsieur Lyotard.
He was a pharmacist, but he never produced the recipe, couldn't quite figure it out. And then it was almost lost again, because then in 1810, Napoleon ordered that all secret recipes of medicines have to be sent to the Ministry of the Interior. So Lyotard submitted the manuscript, you know, following the law, but it was refused. Whoever was in charge of this department looked at it and went like, nah, everybody knows what that is. We don't need that secret, super secret formula.
Wow.
So it gets rejected.
Burn.
Gets sent back. Yeah. And so then it's not until after Lyotard's death, his heirs found the manuscript. Finally, they return it to the chartreuse monks. You know, so this is like 1816, they have their recipe back. They're back in their monastery. They get right back to work. Around 1840, they distill a lighter, sweeter form of chartreuse. This is where yellow chartreuse comes in.
Oh.
This one's like 40% alcohol. It's a fair bit cheaper, I will also say.
Oh, yes.
It's the one I usually like use in like a medium priced menu cocktail is getting yellow chartreuse. Yeah. But it's not calm for long because the distillery is nationalized in 1903. So the monks are kicked out again for about 20 years from their monastery. And basically their distillery gets sold off. The people that eventually have it, they go bankrupt. And then some people, friends of the original monastery, they buy it back and they gift it back to the monks.
Aw, nice. Yes. After a lot of drama. There's a nice happy ending.
They really had to keep fighting to get back in there and keep making their chartreuse.
I can see why they're so tight-lipped about it now.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of drama there. Yeah.
Like, okay. Fuck it. No. We're not telling anyone anymore.
Nobody gets you to know.
No. Well, okay, you know what? Two people.
I was going to say, to this day, only two monks know the recipe.
Nobody else gets to know until somebody dies.
Yeah. That's basically how they do it. Like, two people get to know the recipe, and it's tightly guarded. A lot of people have tried to figure out how to make it, how to replicate it. I feel like at least once a year, I have somebody come through and try to sell me at the bar. Like, this is just like chartreuse, but it's half the price. And I love that idea, because I'll be honest, like, chartreuse is one of those spirits that there's nothing like it. Like, as somebody that makes cocktails, like, if there's a drink that calls for chartreuse, sure, there are things you can kind of fill the void with, but it's always going to be less good, I feel like.
Yeah.
Like, it's just amazing. It has so much going on in it. It brings so much to a drink. So every time I'm brought one of these, I'm excited by the prospect, but it's never as good. Because, you know, it's like I said, it's over 100 ingredients in a very specific balance that's been perfected now over hundreds of years.
300 years.
Yeah.
The elixir vegetal.
I've heard somewhere it was a liquor so good they named a color after it. And it's actually true.
That is true. Yeah. The liquor came first and then the color came later. And you know, when you say chartreuse, like, you're thinking of that, like, somewhere in between yellow and green. It's this perfect, beautiful color.
It's funny. This is a weird aside, but I first learned the word chartreuse not in association with... I knew what the color was from a song from Space Goes Coast to Coast, because Zorak sings, "I'm green, I'm yellow, I'm chartreuse." It's very little color.
Wow.
That's where my concept of the color chartreuse came from.
All right.
Yeah. But there you go. So on the shelf right now, stuff that's actually being made by monks. Now, this, obviously, we're in America where what we have is stuff that's, like, widely imported. And we're talking about stuff that you can kind of find in any, you know, beer store, liquor store. In Europe, there are lots of places that are adjacent to monasteries where you can find local products.
Because most of the Trappist beers are located in Belgium.
Right.
So the closer you are to Belgium, the more likely you're going to find those.
Yeah. But as far as things that kind of reach the international market, you really just have chartreuse and some beers.
Yeah. Chardonnay you might recognize. There's Chimay, La Trappe, which you might, when you saw La Trappe, you would be like, that's made by Trappist monks. Yes, it is. Arcole, Orval, Roquefort, and then there's Westmalle and it's probably a V. This one is probably Westmalle.
Okay.
And then this one is probably Westvelteren. Something like that.
Say it with confidence. It'll be fine.
Westvelteren. I'm going to say that. If you are Belgian and you want to tweet at me with the correct pronunciation, I won't be mad, but I probably won't come back on this podcast and correct myself. I'll probably just do it on Twitter. Just saying. Just putting it out there. If you want to educate me, go for it. I'm into it. I like knowing how to pronounce things correctly, and I'll do it next time. Yeah, right. But those are some, and it's not without imitators. There are plenty of beers out there that use the Trappist model and want you to think that they're Trappist because the Trappist beers kind of stand for quality.
Right.
Yeah, you got to really check, because there's not a lot that we have, especially in America, that are widely available that are actually genuine Trappists.
Yeah. Like, you see a lot of Chimay and Orval, and we found La Trappe, so that's what we're going to...
Yeah.
So we're going to be trying over on the episode.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, well, and speaking of which, I know we're going to get to our mentions after this. Definitely, if you enjoyed this episode, check out the video next, because we're going to be making one of the go-to chartreuse cocktails out there. It's standout. It's delicious. We're also going to be mixing up with some of those monk fakers. Yeah. You know, why not? Well,
I mean, like, the Frangelico bottle is still cute. I'm into it.
Yeah. And then, yeah, we're going to be trying some real Trappist beer.
So fuck yeah.
Come join us.
Yeah. Thank you to all of you who donated to our Patreon. Thanks to all our new Patreon members. You can still join. We're going to put that link below. We use that money to pay for the supplies we need, make those delicious cocktails for you, and get upgrade our equipment and stuff like that. We're also adding some really fun perks that's going to be really exciting. Yes. To our Patreon. We just got a package today.
Just came in the mail today.
Oh my God, I'm so excited. Thank you to everyone who tweeted and retweeted about the show. It really helps us get the word out. I'm going to shout some people out. Terrifyingly Intelligent Nerd Face, Mary Smurl, Spirit, They Call Me Mom, 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 Aiden, Pete Rattleclaw Recluse, Bison of the New Year, Justin Hoops McElroy, Michael Beck, Stephanie Cooperstein, W. What's This, Chris Bennington, Cat's Companion, Caitlin, Joe Whitaker, Tommy Smurl, Dorothy Hoover, Danny, Phil Kunze, Iron Horse, Just a Reminder, The Year is 20 Tony, Dick Twist Tuesday, Jeff Hagen.
Dick Twist Tuesday?
Yep. That's their Twitter name. All right. They don't have a real name on there. Jack Christopher, MJ, Sydney McElroy, Moki Motel, Melissa. Thanks, guys. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at Neat Boozecast. Don't forget that when you tweeted us, say something before you put our handle. If you put our handle first, then nobody else will see it. Thank you to Absurdist for our wonderful theme music. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please subscribe, rate, and give us a review. We love those. We read them. They're so sweet. Head over to our YouTube channel. And I'd really like to close this episode with a Benedictine prayer.
Oh.
It goes like this. O Lord, bless this creature beer, which by your kindness and power has been produced from kernels of grain, and may it be a health-giving drink for mankind.
That accent was... All right, well...
It was my character. I was a monk.
That was a monk accent? You sounded like you're about to, like, introduce a nightmare theater in, like, the 20s.
That was not a nightmare accent.
That sounded very, like, you're about to...
That was a pious library monk.
No, that definitely sounds like you're about to describe an eldritch horror to me.
Listen, I put in the effort.
You did, okay? You did.
That's what matters. That's what matters. Okay. We're done now.
All right. I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been...
Neat.
I was waiting for another accent. Has this been neat?
It's been neat. 'Cause you know what that accent is? It's
Edgar Allan Poe?
No, it's Riff Raff.
It is Riff Raff. That's your monk voice, it's Riff Raff?
Gotta get that out of there,
remember.
Bro.
Oh, no.